Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, we have another awe-inspiring physician who has spent much of her career researching and counseling mitochondrial disease families and other rare disease families as well. She is a biochemical geneticist at Emory University. I'm so happy she is here to tell her story. I think everyone's going to find it really interesting, her background, how she got to where she is today. Welcome, Dr. Rosana Sanchez-Russo. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Marcy. I love that you were able to invite me here and connect with you and more families going through some of these conditions.
Yeah, I think this podcast is so important to kind of arm our community with more information, insight, hopeful news, all of that. That is the point of this podcast. And I think you can hit on so many of those things with an episode, with telling your story, talking about the work you do. So I'm really interested in hearing everything you're going to share. And I know our listeners are going to agree.
Thank you.
You have a really interesting childhood. It's all relevant to the work that you're doing now. Can you share with us like where you got your start and what were you doing as a kid that kind of led to your interests now?
Thank you so much for asking that, because I reflect on that, I think, quite a bit of how, you know, how I got here and how I got interested. I don't know if this is the right word, but maybe passionate.
Passionate, yeah.
This field. And so I can tell you that, interestingly, I was exposed to the hospital environment from a very young age. And this was not as a patient, but I guess I call myself an observer. So I kind of learned this rhythm of the hospital, and I could see it unfold around me because my father used to work at a local pediatric community hospital in Barranquilla, Colombia, where I'm from originally. And I used to go with him sometimes, and it's almost like rounding with him in the hospital. And on my mom's side, she is a psychologist and mostly these children still to date, many of which had a diagnosis of autism. The first interaction that I truly remember that I think was a patient who had a diagnostic condition, genetic condition, was at around 7 years of age. And this child was in front of me and had a difference in how the skull had been formed. And so it was something that was visible. And I remember that I was not scared and I wasn't judging him, but I wanted to understand why did he have these. And I think I posed a difficult question to my father at the time, and it was, what are you doing to help him? And I think that became, what can I do to help others along the way? And I don't think medicine is perfect and science is not perfect, but I think we do try our very best. And with that in mind, as I grew up and encountered more people living with differences, I think I quietly just absorbed all of that. And it steered questions that maybe still now I don't have full answers, but now I at least can articulate some of them and start working on them.
And make an impact in these families' lives, right?
I hope so too.
Yeah. You know, you were exposed to families and people that were at a disadvantage, that had challenges, you know, from your very young age. And you took that and created a passion out of it, right?
I truly did. And that passion is not going anywhere. It's just been, I think, fueled more and more every day.
Well, our community is really lucky to have you working with us on behalf of us, all of that. So did you finish your education in Colombia? How did you, when did you come over to the States? How did that all work?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I, you know, we don't have college in Colombia.
Ah.
So you go to medical school right out of high school.
At 18.
Yeah, I was 17 when I started medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, I kind of had my path semi-carved, and I had this idea that I wanted to go into genetics from an earlier age. And so when I entered medical school, I kind of had that sense of purpose already, which had shaped me along the way. And I think that because I understood what it meant for me, I knew that I could not complete some of the training in Colombia. So when I graduated medical school, I came to the U.S. to do first a pediatric residency that I completed in Miami. And it was a great experience for me. And then I was able to complete training at Emory for medical genetics residency and then biochemical genetics residency, which is really where I started meeting more families with these energy metabolism disorders, and specifically mitochondrial diseases.
Got it. Got it. So you didn't have much exposure to mitochondrial disease care until, or in the field until then?
So I back in Colombia, I think that we were better at diagnosing things that had to do more with different, like birth differences,
okay,
developmental delays. But for some of the biochemical disorders, at the time I was there, because things have advanced, you know, everywhere, including back home, we didn't have as many biochemical tests that we could order. So it was really when I was in pediatric residency where I was the most exposed here in the U.S. to that specific group of conditions and started learning about treatment management and diagnosis more fully.
Got it. So what does intrigue you about energy disease and, I guess, more specifically, mitochondrial disease?
Yeah, I think that I don't think any patient wants to be called complex,
yeah,
or interesting. But for us in medicine, I think that those are notable things on the patients. And just when I start understanding something about some of these conditions, then I realize I'm just scratching the surface here. That is frustrating for, I think, both the people taking care of people with the conditions and the people themselves. But I think that's what's leading us to keep trying to bridge into the gaps in the care, both with diagnostics and also therapeutics. So I think that's one of the things that I'm trying to maybe understand. And then I would say the other thing that makes this group of conditions also so notable is that each patient is so unique to each other. The amount of symptoms, the severity of each symptoms, how they change over time, and then how we may be able to have better understanding of these things to intervene in a different way, and then have more, you know, you hear this a lot about like personalized approaches, mm-hmm, to the treatment. I think that's another part that intrigues me as I, you know, learn more about them.
So do you think that there's room for us to grow in personalizing the care for mito patients?
I do. I have, you know, I don't want to be naive, but I do have hope. And I want patients to have hope as well. I don't think we have, you know, fully standardized,
yeah,
right now, or specific FDA approved medications. But I know how hard the community is also working,
mm-hmm,
in helping us be able to advance this field. And one of the things that I do see has gotten better is we're getting better at diagnosis. We're diagnosing people even earlier,
okay,
than what we were. And I think this is allowing us that deeper knowledge and understanding of the conditions to then know what to target for treatments. And I do know of many other clinicians who are purposefully studying these diseases and trying to do clinical trials.
Okay. So from the time that you entered into mitochondrial disease care till now, do you feel like there are more people with their hands on it?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I see it. I see it even within our clinic. We have a geneticist who we just recently recruited into our team, who started very recently, who has a specific interest in starting a clinic for patients with mitochondrial diseases.
Really?
That I'm hoping that I can help her build this. I know that coming to a geneticist is time consuming, but I think building that expertise is going to be very key. Her name is Lily Walson, and we also count with a genetic counselor in the clinic who came from New York, who already had special interest in this condition. So
really?
Because it's not a one-man job. So I think that is something that can be built. And the other thing that I think is coming into this picture is that we have a nutritionist who's also a scientist who's working both with the state to get funding for the nutritional supplements, but also she's been collaborating with the local compounding pharmacies to standardize mitochondrial cocktails. So I think all of these things are coming together at a similar time.
Wow.
And I think collectively, this is going to be this foundation for a new clinic and with more specialized care. So I'm very excited about that being an opportunity that we'll be able to hopefully start sharing with patients soon.
Everything you just shared is, I mean, that's a really big deal, all of those pieces.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I'm very excited for Dr. Walson to be able to do this because she's been, since training, because she trained with us, saying this, and she's found this niche, this passion for herself that really, I think, is going to fuel her.
That's awesome. I feel like, you know, I go to doctor's appointments, we all go to doctor's appointments, and so many of our physicians have not even heard of mitochondrial disease, unfortunately. You know, it's just the basics that they know that we all learned in science class, right? Or hopefully they know a little bit more, and not to discredit anyone, but you know, there's a lot to know about the body and how it all works. But to hear that there are people out there that really are passionate about making a difference and changing the treatments and the therapies, that's great insight.
Yeah, and I'm hopeful that that can be done soon and we can get started and then start collaborating with other centers. You know, once we're organized and start seeing patients, the patients themselves are going to be the ones telling us these are the next needs. And then we go from there.
And then hopefully, as we'll call it a center of care, I don't know, for lack of other term, maybe other institutions around the country would take that model and could build something as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we've had support from centers like CHOP helping us with our patients, and sometimes we co-manage them. And it's been great because we get more of that hands-on experience from people who've done this longer than us. And so we're very thankful that we are at least in a community within genetics that everyone really wants all the other centers to learn and succeed.
I really like hearing that. I am curious, from your perspective, what are some of the best ways for a family to prepare for their first meeting with a geneticist?
I'm going to use the word patient. I think that when someone comes to our clinic, sometimes they have no idea what to expect. And sometimes they're referred and they don't know why they're there, or they don't know what to share with us. The nice thing is that in our initial evaluations, you're usually there like at least for an hour face to face with our team, and you may encounter different people along the way. And so we usually are very careful in reviewing someone's history before they come in, and then their own personal experiences. So we may know some of it, but you'll hear us asking again just so that we get a better understanding of timelines and how things have evolved over time. We go very in-depth, in detail, through the family histories as well, because that can clue us into if things are genetic and inherited or genetic and brand new, because both of those exist. And then we also perform physical exams that also help us make decisions. And then there's time spent discussing things like genetic testing, what's most appropriate at the time, and, you know, insurance considerations and other things that maybe most of us don't want to talk about, but we should. And so throughout the visit, we try to set certain goals because we work closely with the genetic counseling team. and they're very good at asking up, you know, upfront, what are your goals? To be sure that if there's expectations that we can meet, that we have them into account right away. And it's very nice because I do think that patients end up these visits with us understanding why they're there and what are the next steps that we're taking.
So you meet with families before the genetic testing is done. And then after the testing is done, would they only meet with a genetic counselor or do you stay as part of their care team?
Usually I stay unless most of the care is going to be done by other specific physicians and they only needed the counseling part.
Okay.
But if they needed the physical exam and or we're going to be involved in any decisions for surveillance, you know, ordering labs or specific medications, then we're going to be part of your team for the lifespan or the time that you are with us in the center. So we see everyone from birth to old age. And many of our patients who have chronic conditions that we manage, we see them throughout our lifetime. So the nice thing is that for many families, if we are kind of your home for chronic care, they don't have to transition out of the geneticist. They may have to transition from pediatric to adult for other things, but in our center, they can stay with the geneticist throughout their lifetime.
That has to be comforting because the idea, like I feel like I could never move because I found specialists that are good to me. I was diagnosed as an adult, so I never had to switch from pediatrics to adult. So the idea of switching from pediatrics to adult is definitely something in the same vein. Like I would never move because I would never want to start those relationships over and have to teach people about who I am and what I go through. And
it's hard. And that transition is hard.
Yeah. So after that first appointment, then typically genetic testing is sent out, mm-hmm. and then you reconvene once all the information is back.
Typically, there are patients who sometimes get to us referred who've already had genetic testing.
Sure.
Because many providers may be doing them. And either they have sometimes a positive result, like an explanation to their symptoms, and we're meeting them for the first time, but also going over the results on the same clinic visit
uh-huh.
and making a plan of care. Or they may have some uncertain results that they didn't understand very well, and we're doing more of the counseling side at that point. So they may be getting to us with a diagnosis or with an uncertain diagnosis or just first-time genetic testing. I would say the majority haven't had genetic testing yet. And then once we have the results, particularly if we find a positive result or an uncertain result where we are either doing next steps for care or understanding if some uncertain results could be the cause of the symptoms, or we're going to give them a diagnosis and, you know, start a plan of care, then we bring them back in either virtually or in person. At that time, usually it's also one of the geneticists and the genetic counselors in the clinic or one of the residents or other learners that may be with us.
Mm-hmm.
If a dietitian needs to be involved, then that also includes the dietitian at the follow-up. And then together we make a plan with the family.
Got it. I love that there's a nutritionist involved. I would say that's been such a lacking area in my care. And I wish that I had someone that really specialized in mito nutrition.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think most people, you know, there's like a great standard even for that. There's a few of the mitochondrial conditions where, you know, ketogenic diet is a standard
yeah.
of care, but not for most. And what works for one person may not work for the other. So I do mm-hmm. think that long-term, that's an area that is definitely needed to be explored more. I know centers
right.
like CHOP do have usually the nutritionist involved upfront. For us here, I think we would more have them involved if we need them for a specific care.
That makes sense. I feel like I've gotten a lot of answers, kind of like what you said, is there's not a specific diet per se or things to stay away from for my specific condition. I wish there were rules, I wish there was like something I could control, you know, and I feel like there have to be some answers within, you know, diet and all of that. And I don't know that it's known yet, right?
I also think that there are things that we don't understand. I think for some diseases, we know like they may not be able to process the fats in the same way because the process to break down the fats happen within the mitochondria for depending on the size of the fats, but the typical ones that we eat in the diet usually are broken down there. And if you can't process them well, then that makes sense that a high fat diet may not be the best, right? For many of the disorders or the majority of them. But are there other things and other fuels that would be better? And what's the maybe percentages of what you should be, you know, I think that's so hard to measure. And I think
I'm sure it is. I just wish there was some sort of rubric.
We've started sometimes trying to do something like a calorimetry and seeing how people are using energy in the hospital and outside, but that's less clinical based right now for us.
Yeah.
And then when you get the results, I do still find it difficult to say, okay, with these results, what am I exactly supposed to do? Because we don't have enough experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do think these are things that we have to think about and that will evolve over the next years.
I feel like there's so many high level things about like drug development and research and gene therapy and all of this. And like on a day to day basis, I just wonder maybe there is something that I could be doing differently, you know, in very simple terms with the way I eat. It's just something I think about often, and I bring it up when I bring it up on the podcast whenever I can. The listeners are probably sick of hearing about it, so I guess we should be done with that topic. But it just intrigues me, you know, like there's all these high level things, but is there something simple that I could be doing, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's secondary mitochondrial dysfunction for many reasons too. Chronic diseases, medications we may take. So I think that many people have these types of questions that you're posing right now about diet and longevity, you know, and just even outside the primary mitochondrial diseases. So I see why people always bring it up. I get those questions a lot.
I'm not the only one.
You are not the only one.
I'm curious, how has mitochondrial disease care changed in the last 10 years? What are some of the improvements that you think will make the most impact on individual patient care, outside maybe of your clinic specifically?
Yeah. Well, I think that we talked about this a little bit earlier. The earlier diagnosis, I think, is key. And then the multidisciplinary care. And people in different subspecialties understanding how different organ systems are impacted by mitochondrial diseases. And even though that may not be treating the disease per se, you're treating the symptom that can still help, I think, the person and the quality of life overall.
For sure.
I think I'm seeing maybe more use of certain supplements. And although we don't have maybe many clinical trials for many of them, I think we are understanding that, you know, because they may be antioxidants, right? That may be helping the mitochondria. They may be substrates, things that your mitochondria uses to make some other things, or the products that may not be made well that we're starting to supplement and understand more that may be helping. I know centers like Baylor have some studies with citrulline, one of the amino acids, that may be able to help. And so I think these things are coming up. We're starting to have more understanding of maybe who may benefit the most and then why. Why? What is it doing at specific levels within the different pathways of the mitochondria? So I do think that that part is going to improve. I think that you were mentioning things like gene therapy. I think those are the emerging, more maybe targeted therapies that I'm hoping that in the next decade may start coming up. I think it's going to be easier to have some of those for genes that come from the nuclear DNA than the specific mitochondrial DNA, just because of how they are in different organ systems. I think the other difficulty that we have, which is, if we see it in a different way, an opportunity, is how to target the correct cell types to get the treatments to where they're supposed to go. But I think that if I'm thinking about it and you're asking about it, that means people who are smarter than me are also thinking about this and will hopefully have better answers than I have today.
Well, I think that there's a lot on the horizon. I really try to make sure that all of our episodes are talking about all of that. And I know that there, you may think there are people that are smarter than you, but they're then way, way smarter than me. But I just like to bring the info to our community. And I think you've done a great job with that. I think your center sounds amazing. I think that patients are probably very lucky to be a part of, you know, the care that you're giving. And I am so glad that you've been able to be on our podcast. I do have a question, though. This is something I just think about personally, but what about mitochondrial care in Colombia? Are you familiar with that? I know your career has been here, but what is it like there? Are there mito specialists? Is there a focus there?
That is a great question. I know that they have geneticists, and they do have a couple of residency across the country in genetics. When people do genetics there, there's not like a very specific biochemical fellowship, but they do learn about biochemical disorders. And now there's a few labs that can do biochemical testing. And they're starting to send out more exomes and genomes outside of Colombia, because many of the labs just don't have the capacity to run them, but they can send them out. And I know because I've helped review some of the ones that come from the country for translation services too.
Oh, wow.
Interestingly. And so I know that it's possible to get the diagnosis, but I don't think there's specific clinics just for mitochondrial diseases. We do have capabilities of having supplements, but we have amazing clinicians back home. They're really very well-rounded doctors. We don't have genetic counselors. That's not one of the training pathways.
Oh,
we have like a master's degree, but we don't have it back home. I do think that at some point, you know, those things may start trickling down to other countries in South America. But I know that people from Colombia that I see sometimes here in meetings or even abroad in meetings are always keeping themselves up to date and going to meetings like the Society of Inherited Metabolic Diseases and the European versions of that. And so I know that even if we didn't have everything for diagnosis back home, they're doing their very best to keep themselves up to date and try to support patients however they can.
Well, you've been really interesting to listen to and very informative. And again, I think your patients are very lucky to have you. Thank you so much for being a part of our podcast and spending time with us and making us feel hopeful about the future. And I hope we see some of this stuff on the horizon. And I hope that everything really comes together at the center in Emory where you're working. And I wish all of you so much good luck in your pursuits of finding more information and better treatments. And I hope you all work together very harmoniously, right?
I thank you so much, Marcy, for having me here and chatting with me throughout. And thank you for saying that. I do hope that my patients feel like they're getting good care. I'm very fond of them, really, and I do want the best for them and the community at large. And I do also hope that if clinical trials and other things come our way, that we can be even a center for them and help the patients through it and navigate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And keep doing all of the great work you're doing. We all need you. So thanks for putting your energy into mitochondrial disease care. Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.